The headlines: the UN mission in Afghanistan raises the death toll from an attack targeting an exam center in Kabul to 35. Tens of thousands of rail workers in Britain walk off the job, paralyzing train services, and protest over pay and working conditions. And the Palestinian Resistance Front warns Tel Aviv of a heavy confrontation after Israeli military officials threatened to assassinate resistance leaders. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. In Afghanistan, Hazara women and civil rights activists rally in the capital, Kabul, to condemn recent terrorist attacks against the Shia Hazara community. The protesters chanted "Stop the Hazara genocide" and "We want justice" while marching on the streets. The rally was staged a day after a suicide attack targeted an educational center in an area mainly populated by the Hazara community in western Kabul. According to the UN mission in that country, the blast left nearly 35 people dead and many more injured. Many of those killed were teenage girls who were getting extra tuition, preparation for university entrance exams. Journalist Said Zafar Mehdi says terror attacks in Afghanistan continue unabated without receiving worldwide condemnation.
Unfortunately, as you can see, there are no hashtags for them. No condemnation, no press marches, no candlelight vigils, no probes. And this cycle of violence, this unending cycle of violence, targeting them has somehow been normalized over the years. And this is a country that has never seen peace. You know, if you go back in history, it was British, then it was Soviet, then it was Americans and their allies, and now it's Daesh. Daesh is, of course, a proxy of Western powers that has filled this vacuum left by U.S.-led NATO forces. I see blood of these innocents killed in yesterday's attack in this predominantly Shia neighborhood of Dasht-e Bashti in western Kabul in the hands of Americans. You know, they are responsible for this mess, for the rise and resurgence of this terrorist group. You know, since 2014, when this Daesh terrorist group made first inroads in the country, they have been relentlessly bombing mosques, schools, hospitals, you know, that belong to this community. Dasht-e Bashti and other smaller pockets which are inhabited by Shias in Kabul have been the main targets. I myself have survived at least two such attacks when I was stationed in Kabul as a journalist some years ago.
On to Iraq, where scuffles have broken out between protesters and security forces. Thousands of people gathered to mark the third anniversary since anti-government protests that shook the country in 2019. Protesters gathered at the Al-Jumhuriya Bridge in the capital, Baghdad. They threw stones and tried to break down barriers. Police retaliated by using tear gas to disperse the crowd. Over 40 people have been injured, including policemen. In 2019, protests erupted against then-Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi's government. Demonstrators demanded an overhaul of the political system, which they believe is profoundly corrupt and keeps people in poverty. Iraq has been mired in political paralysis that has left the country without a head of state and government since October of last year. A teacher in Italy risks a disciplinary sanction for cutting off an Iranian student's hair. The man did this after the minor refused to show solidarity for the protests taking place in Iran. Our correspondent Max Civilli has more.
The High School of Human Sciences Leonardo da Vinci is located in central Rome, not far from the Colosseum. The school has a good reputation. It offers a mix of classical and modern studies and a cultural background which, reads its website, allows pupils to access any university faculty. However, earlier this week, one of Leonardo da Vinci's teachers cut a lock of hair from an Iranian student after urging her to express solidarity with the protests taking place in Iran. The underage girl had remained unresponsive to the teacher's request.
We were shocked at the teacher's behavior. He targeted an Iranian minor because of her nationality and made the student feel that expressing solidarity was an act due for her. An act of exclusion from the class was then turned into an act of violence when the teacher humiliated the student by cutting a lock of her hair.
The teacher was addressing his pupils on the issue of protests in Iran that have been going on for days after the tragic death of 22-year-old girl Mahsa Amini. On Friday, we reached the principal of the Leonardo da Vinci School, but she politely refused to be interviewed, saying that Italy's education authority has forbidden all school staff from engaging with the media on the issue. The teacher involved in the case risks now a disciplinary sanction. Even the mayor of Rome, Roberto Gualtieri, has said the episode concerning the Iranian student, if confirmed, would be an unacceptable form of bullying.
For sure there was violence in the way the teacher behaved. The whole story revolves around someone who has been bullied and their attacker. In between were the other students stunned, petrified, because of the teacher's gesture. They suddenly acted as if they were attendants. They were passive, resigned, a common attitude in our society.
The fact that a teacher, who is someone who should encourage free thinking and the natural reflection of wanting to do something for oneself, I don't know, I think it was absolutely unnecessary, and they should definitely face some consequences.
Also, the National Association of Principals of Rome has condemned the teacher's gesture, saying that teachers should always act with great caution and that principals must ensure that schools are a place of growth and not a place where one looks for media exposure. Max Civili, Rome.
British commuters are facing travel chaos as tens of thousands of railway workers go on a strike in disputes over pay and job security. This is the largest one-day rail strike in decades, involving three major trade unions and more than 50,000 workers across the country. Officials say only around 11% of train services will operate on Saturday. In some parts, there will be no trains at all. The strike will also hamper travel to the ruling Conservative Party's annual conference in Birmingham, due to begin tomorrow. Our London correspondent Syed Pourreza joined us with more details on the British railway workers' strike and their key demands.
And it looks like the so-called summer of discontent has spilled over into autumn. Of course, the strike that is happening today had been planned for September, but the death of the late monarch Queen Elizabeth II delayed everything. Other strikes are planned for later in the month. There are two sides to this dispute over pay, pensions, and new conditions. One is the unions. One of them we've been talking about a lot is the RMT, the Railway, Maritime, and Transport Union, very powerful union headed by Mick Lynch, General Secretary, and a number of other unions. And on the other side, you have National Network Rail, rather, which is the public arm of the UK's transportation ministry. They have been debating over a pay rise for months now. Those negotiations are still rumbling on, and there doesn't seem to be a consensus or a settlement in sight just yet. What the unions are asking for their workers, drivers, more than 53,000 of whom are on strike today, hence the situation the country is facing, is they want a pay rise that is in keeping with the inflation rate, that is in the double digits.
And staying with the UK, people are rallying in all major cities across the country to protest against the rising living costs. In the capital, London, people are gathering in a number of places, including Queen's Gardens and Hull City Centre, to call for action. Representatives from the opposition Labour Party and trade unionists are scheduled to give speeches. People have called on celebrities to join in. They demand higher pay for workers and taxes on the rich. The cost of living has been increasing across the UK since early 2021. The annual rate of inflation reached nearly 10% in August 2022, close to a 30-year high. The increase affected the affordability of goods and services for households. Palestinian resistance groups have warned the Israeli regime against any attempt to target their senior members. The group said that Tel Aviv should be awaiting a tough military response if it carries out its threat to assassinate Palestinian commanders. They said Israeli troops will face death if they attack the Jenin refugee camp north of the occupied West Bank. Jenin has been the focal point of an Israeli crackdown against Palestinians in recent months. The Palestinian groups also warned that Israeli troops will die both inside their armored vehicles and on the streets as a result of heavy fire by resistance groups. The warning comes after Chief of the General Staff of the Israeli military, Aviv Kochavi, threatened to assassinate senior Palestinian commanders. My correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says the Israeli regime is preventing Palestinian resistance groups from conducting any activities in the occupied West Bank.
The Israeli regime is completely refusing any move by the Palestinian armed groups or by the Palestinian resistance movement or any kind of Palestinian activities in the occupied West Bank. They want to prevent any action of activities, any form of resistance against the Israeli forces and the Israeli soldiers. And from here, the Israeli troops continue to raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis. Confrontations take place between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. And at the end of the day, let's say at least every week, a number of Palestinians are being killed. Those whom the Israelis claim they are wanted for security reasons. At the end of the day, those are Palestinians engaged in different forms of resistance. They are members of the different Palestinian, Palestinian resistance groups. But the move and the thing that is dangerous now, the Israelis might not be going to confrontations or clashes. They are choosing the easy way. The easy way for the Israeli soldiers is to assassinate the leaders and activists of the Palestinian resistance groups in the occupied West Bank, of course.
The Russian move on the four Ukrainian regions has been met with a backlash by some Western countries in the UN Security Council. During our news review program, we discussed that with our guest. Let's take a listen.
And I welcome everyone to our news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. And now Russia has vetoed a Western-backed resolution at the United Nations Security Council, which condemns its annexation of four Ukrainian territories. The resolution, co-sponsored by the United States, aimed to isolate Russia in its war in Ukraine. It would have called on Moscow to immediately withdraw its forces from Ukrainian territories. China, Brazil, India, and Gabon abstained from the vote. During the Security Council session, the U.S. ambassador said the U.N. was built on the idea of not allowing a country to take another's territory by force. The Russian ambassador to the UN pushed back by condemning U.S.-initiated resolution as a hostile action. Ambassador Vasilina Benzia said there will be no turning back for annexation of the Ukrainian territories, arguing locals made an informed and free choice to join Russia. And joining us now for the program is Scott Bennett, political commentator, joining us out of San Francisco, California. Mr. James Jotras, former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst, joining us from Virginia. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Mr. Jotras, we're going to start with you, sir, if we may. Good to have you on. Your thoughts on what this resolution was supposed to accomplish. Obviously, many knew it was going to get basically either vetoed down or shot down by other countries, considering Russia's a world power and carries that veto, so does China. So what was the whole point of it, Mr. Joshua? What was the point the U.S. was trying to make, and to what end?
It was political theater, of course. It was simply to have a resolution that would condemn Russia, that Russia would, of course, veto. I think the downside for the American policy is that not only China, which was to be expected, but that India and Brazil would not support the resolution. And of course, Russia doesn't need them to vote on its side. It just needs them not to vote on the American side. So I don't think this is actually a very big plus for Washington in this regard.
Right. Really quick, I'm going to welcome Scott. Scott, welcome to the program there. But your initial thoughts on the story, Scott?
Well, you know, the independence of Luhansk, Donetsk, Crimea, and eastern Ukraine is simply following the Declaration of Independence that the United States of America made in 1776. The Ukrainian people have held that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And they saw their only way of containing and maintaining their lives was to join Russia and escape the clutches of the demoniac Zelensky and his Nazi hordes. So it's fascinating in the hypocrisy and the lies when the U.S. condemns people seeking to preserve their lives and preserve their language and culture
and follow traditional family values and marriage between a man and a woman, and not worshiping the environment and a slavish climate change religion, this is the future of a healthy humanity in the direction that Russia and these republics are going. And I think Europe is about to totally collapse economics. That's what the United States is engineering through its act of terrorism and blowing up the natural gas pipeline. So I wouldn't be surprised if Russia retaliates by pulling out all diplomatic conversations, tearing the phone out of the wall, and having nothing to do with the United States, and making an appeal saying all people in Europe and America that want family values and truth and freedom, come to Russia, because it's obvious now you're in a police state of madness and hypocrisy and lies, and that is a nation and a hemisphere that is doomed to be destroyed by God because of their hypocrisy, their sin, and their wickedness. So I think Russia is being blessed and being raised up on a very high pedestal, and the rest of the nations are recognizing it, and they're turning from the United States in favor of Russia.
Gentlemen, thank you both. It's always a pleasure to check in with both of you. Scott Bennett, they're joining us from San Francisco, and Mr. James Jotras joining us out of Virginia. And that brings us to the conclusion of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng on Friday, 30th of September, refused to bow to demands to publish an early forecast of government growth plans and the impact of planned tax cuts, which have led to turmoil in the financial markets. Stay with us for the world media's coverage of this story. Britain's Guardian newspaper tells us more. Britain's Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng have refused to release independent analysis of their tax plans until more than 6 weeks after receiving them, despite more calls from Tory MPs for Downing Street to reassure the markets. The Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer said They would only publish the independent forecasts on 23rd of November alongside a fiscal statement, despite them being ready on 7th of October. Several Conservative MPs have already urged Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng to allow the Office for Budget Responsibility, the OBR, Britain's independent fiscal watchdog, to reveal its forecast as soon as possible, including Conservative MP Mel Stride, the chair of the Treasury Committee. Peter Alders, another Tory MP, said on Friday that the fiscal plan with new rules should be brought forward. Writing for the House of Commons magazine, he said, "Time is running out to show the British people that the Conservative Party deserves to retain the honour of serving as their government." Another Tory MP, Charles Walker, conceded the party had lost the next election and said the government had a duty to the country to get the public finances in the best possible shape before it is lost. However, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng do not appear to be bowing to pressure from their own party. The pair met the chair of the Office of Budget Responsibility, Richard Hughes, on Friday, 30th of September, after a week of turmoil in the financial markets, in response to Kwasi Kwarteng's mini-budget promising tax cuts funded by borrowing, without any accompanying independent growth forecasts. After the mini-budget, the British pound plunged, mortgage rates soared, and the Bank of England had to stage an emergency £65 billion intervention to bail out pension funds. The Treasury has been facing calls from its select committee to allow the Office of Budget Responsibility to release forecasts earlier to reassure the financial markets, to reassure the public and the Parliament that the government's plan will lead to higher growth. However, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng appear to be holding firm against that idea. The pound, which hit a one-week high at 1.1235 for US dollar at 10 a.m. on Friday, has dipped back into negative territory against the dollar. It is currently trading 0.1% lower at $1.11. The Treasury said Liz Truss, Kwasi Kwarteng and Richard Hughes had discussed the process for the upcoming economic and fiscal forecast, which will be published on 23rd of November, and the economic and fiscal outlook. They agreed, as is usual, to work closely together throughout the forecast process and beyond, it said. The Prime Minister and Chancellor reaffirmed their commitment to the independent Office of Budget Responsibility and made clear that they value its scrutiny. Following the meeting, the Office of Budget Responsibility confirmed its forecast would be ready to deliver to the Chancellor on 7th of October and would, as always, be based on our independent judgment about economic and fiscal prospects and the impact of the government's policies. In a statement after the meeting, which appears to last less than 50 minutes, the Office of Budget Responsibility said, "We discussed the economic and fiscal outlook and the forecast we are preparing for the Chancellor's medium-term fiscal plan." In interviews on Friday, Liz Truss showed no sign of rowing back from the controversial mini-budget. She also insisted there could have been a full forecast produced by the Office of Budget Responsibility in time for last week's fiscal event, even though the public finance watchdog said it had prepared interim figures that were ready to be published. In that timescale, there couldn't be a full Office of Budget Responsibility forecast, but we are committed to the Office of Budget Responsibility forecast, she said. We're working together with the OBR. There will be an event on 23rd of November where the policies are fully analysed by the Office of Budget Responsibility. Reuters news agency tells us more about the same story. British Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng on Friday refused to bow to demands to publish an early forecast of government growth plans and impact of planned tax cuts, which have led to turmoil in the financial markets. Kwasi Kwarteng unveiled a string of lower taxes last week that were unusually not accompanied by forecasts from the Office for Budget Responsibility. A resulting sell-off led to the Bank of England to intervene with emergency bond buying to protect pension funds from partial collapse. Kwasi Kwarteng has come under pressure to allay market fears and bring forward a fiscal statement planned for 23rd of November, when he has said he would publish the Office of Budget Responsibility forecasts and detail the costs of the debt finance tax cuts, along with a path to lower debt in the medium term. However, after Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng met the Office of Budget Responsibility's chair, Richard Hughes, on Friday, the finance ministry said the timing of Kwarteng's medium-term fiscal plan was unchanged. They discussed the process for the upcoming economic and fiscal forecasts, which will be published on 23rd of November, and the economic and fiscal outlook, the Treasury confirmed in a statement. They agreed, as usual, to work closely together throughout the forecast process. The Office of Budget Responsibility said the first draft will be delivered to Kwasi Kwarteng on 7th of October, and it would, as always, be based on our independent judgment about economic and fiscal prospects and the impact of government's policies. The watchdog had said on Thursday it had offered to produce an analysis for Kwasi Kwarteng's tax-cutting plan, but were not commissioned to do so. A senior parliamentary committee has joined those urging Kwasi Kwarteng to bring forward his November statement to calm financial markets, echoing calls from other lawmakers in the ruling Conservative Party. Andrew Griffith, the minister who oversees the City of London financial district, earlier said the projections should not be rushed. "We all want the forecast to be done as quickly as possible, as the Office of Budget Responsibility can, but also you also want them to have the right level of detail." Liz Truss, who only replaced Boris Johnson as Prime Minister this month, has argued that the market turbulence is a result of global problems caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and that she will stick to her plans to snap the economy out of years of stagnant growth. Liz Truss also says the government had to intervene to provide support to help people and businesses with their energy bills, a package that the government said would cost about £60 billion for the next 6 months in order to keep a typical British household's bill to under £2,500 a year. Official data showed on Friday that Britain's economy grew in the second quarter but was still below its pre-pandemic peak. Critics have said Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng should have included forecasts from the Office of Budget Responsibility to reassure financial markets about where the funding would come from before announcing their proposed £45 billion tax cuts.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the Minbar you are listening to. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
The Prophet says there are 10 things though of the dunya that this person will get, and there are 10 things of the akhirah that this person will get. Inshallah, we'll go through these tonight quickly. He says 10 of them in the dunya, 10 of them the akhirah, as for those that are in the dunya. Number one, hub of my Ahlul Bayt is going to have the benefit of az-zuhd fi dunya. Wow. love of Ahlul Bayt will entail the fact that I'm not too interested in this dunya. Al-hirsu ala al-amal, number two. Number three, al-wara'u fi al-deen. Wara' means extra precaution. We have a hadith that says, akhuka deenuk fahtat li-deenik. Your brother is your deen and religion. Have some ihtiyat when it comes to your religion. Now, our fiqh, alhamdulillah, our fuqaha, our maraji', have identified which places we have to practice ihtiyat, which places we don't have to practice ihtiyat. But it's not like, oh, until I don't know, I'm good to go. No. You have people that come up to you, Mulana, like, you know, is this haram? You're like, let me look it up. And so he's like, okay, I'll do it until you come with an answer. No, that's not how it works. What if there's a problem here? If you don't know the ruling, they say it's wajib to do ihtiyat. But no, if you know the ruling, and you're not sure, is this applicable to this situation, that situation? In some cases, you don't have to do ihtiyat, sometimes you do. In other words, there will be places and times in our deen that we have to practice ihtiyat. Are we going to do that or not? Al-wara'u fi deen. I am super careful not to walk on the edge. People say, oh, it's no big deal if we are sitting somewhere in isolation and we don't commit sins. We have to be in the middle of sin and then don't commit sin. Habibi, what are you talking about? First of all, it's common sense. Second of all, have you seen the hadith that say you stay away as much as you can from haram environments? Oh, but there's no big deal. Don't worry about the big deal, okay? Shaitan taught us that it's harder than you think. He failed his test. This idea, I have not seen one scholar, brothers and sisters, one scholar say, put yourself in a haram environment, then it's worth it. Then it has value, excuse me. They don't say that. Don't worry. Haram environments, haram situations shall come up. You don't have to chase them. They will come after you. Especially on this side of the world. Well, I mean, in this day and age, any part of the world you're in, actually. It will come after you. You just have to be ready for it. The smaller harams that you are observing, watching out for, will get you ready for the bigger ones that will come. And Allah will send them at the right time. But if you haven't done the work with the smaller ones, how are you going to expect to pass the bigger ones? No, we must put ourselves in that. The only thing that's worth something is if, man, it doesn't match common sense. I'm sorry. Al-wara'u fid-deen, to be careful means I hang out with the right people, not with the wrong people. No, I'm going to hang out with people that are enemies of God, but no, I'm careful. We have seen more than enough cases of people. They started out good, hung out with the wrong people. Eventually, you find them elsewhere. Al-wara'u fid-deen, I would say, encompasses all of this. Why am I going to have wara' fid-deen? Because for Ahlul Bayt, everything was for them was the deen. They did everything for the deen. Imam Hussein, stay in Mecca. Don't worry. No, I'm going to be careful. Why? Because the deen is so important. I'm going to leave Mecca because I'm afraid the Kaaba will be compromised because of me. Number four, al-raghbatu fil ibadah. When are we going to reach this one? Al-raghbatu fil ibadah. Out of all the things the imams love, out of all the things the Prophet loves, the cream of that is going to be ibadah, for sure. But I'm not going to comment on this one, brothers and sisters. Al-raghbatu fil ibadah means you're inclined to ibadah. All I'm going to say is this much. How much is the model that we have today catering towards this? I don't know. Number five, at-tawbatu qabla al-maut. This is cool because it doesn't say at-tawbatu right away. It says at-tawbatu qabla al-maut. In other words, look, this person understands that I have to make sure that I leave this dunya, inshallah, in a clean state. Okay? So the imam says they make sure they do tawbah in this life before they leave for the next. But my question is this. If I tell you that you should do tawbah before death, is that any different than me saying you have to do tawbah right away? Think about it. If this was a workshop, I would ask people to answer me. Is there a difference between saying you must do tawbah before you die and you must do tawbah right away after you commit a sin? Is there a difference, practically speaking, or not? Well, it depends. If you know that you're going to die, yeah, October 28, 2026, then yes, please make sure you do tawbah before October 28, 2026. But who can guarantee they know when they're going to die? In other words, if you want to make sure that you have repented from wrong, you want to make sure you've repented from wrong before your death, what does that mean? That means I don't know if I'm alive tomorrow, so let me make sure I do tawbah today. So practically, does it make a difference? No, it doesn't make a difference. Even these secular people say this. They say, look, the past has passed. Tomorrow, there's no guarantee. Live the now. I'm going to switch it up a bit and render it like this. The past is the past. The future, I'm not sure. Let me do tawbah today. Yeah. These sayings they have, you can always give it an Islamic twist. Just do it, Nike. No, no. Just do it so that you can build your akhirah. When it comes to a'mal and good things, just do it. And whatever else you can think of, I'm sure I can twist it in a certain way that will serve the purpose I'm after. All right. Next one. A person who loves the Ahlul Bayt, it says here, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "An-nashatu fi qiyam al-layl." Once again, no comment. Okay? Because I had no comment to make about al-raghbatu fil ibadah that the Prophet said. He spoke about ibadah in general. Yeah? I mean, I don't know. Like, if we have a chance, in the day and age we live today, it's hard to make it to center in time and all of that. But wow, like, if there is a Salat al-Jama'ah somewhere, if I can make it, why not? Ibadah in general, the Prophet spoke about. Now here he puts his finger on Qiyam al-Layl. No comment, brothers and sisters. To get up a little bit before Salat al-Fajr. Right? 5 minutes, 10 minutes. We knew one of these ulama said, I'm going to like really bring the bar really low for myself even. He said, look, Ay Fatiminiya, he says this. He says, look, if you set the alarm, let's say, Fajr is 6 o'clock, you set the alarm for 5:45. Let me wake up 5 minutes earlier, 10 minutes earlier, pray 2 rak'ah nafilah, for example. You wake up and you're just not feeling it, man. You're just too tired. What does he say? He says, at least as you're turning over in your bed to snooze that thing, you say, Ya Arhamar Rahimin, Ya Akram Al Akramin. Just call Allah with two lines. Can we do that? Can we afford that, brothers and sisters? Call Him in the middle of the night if you can't wake up even. Wow. If you know you're not going to wake up, you're young, you're too old, whatever, you know you can't wake up earlier, we have hadiths that say, pray your Salat al-Layl before you go to sleep, for example. Like, Allah's like giving us all these cheat codes. Yeah? All these shortcuts as if. Who knows, on the Day of Judgment, we might see somebody who never woke up for Salat al-Layl, but then their report card is all Salat al-Layl. Why? Because they at least took these solutions that the Imams were giving them. A person, he says, who loves Ahlul Bayt takes this serious. And Nashat, by the way, Nashat means liveliness. Liveliness. This isn't going to happen overnight. Hey, 18-year-old who's listening to me right now. It's going to take practice. But inshallah, when you reach 30, 35, 40, you're not like when you were 18. Things take time. But at least we have a list in front of us of things that they have expectations of towards us.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati Ghafur Shakur قيوم رؤوف صابر مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In a situation where the Biden administration's comprehensive support for Ukraine against Russia continues, the result of the latest opinion polls indicate a decrease in the support of the American public for these aids. The recent opinion polls show that almost half of the American public are against their country's arms assistance to Ukraine. Economic experts say U.S. arms aid to Ukraine continues at a time when most of the American public are facing poverty, high consumer prices, unprecedented inflation, and livelihood problems. Some political analysts also say that by sending huge cargoes of arms and weaponry to Ukraine, in fact, the United States and Britain want to test the effectiveness of their weapons. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today tells us more about this story. The Pentagon issued a list of American military aid approved for Ukraine so far this year, outlining nearly $17 billion in arms sales and military weapons, including tens of thousands of anti-tank systems, just shy of 1 million artillery rounds, and an array of heavy and long-range weapons platforms. A fact sheet on U.S. security assistance to Ukraine, released by the Pentagon, recently notes that Washington has authorized $16.9 billion worth in military aid for Kiev in 2022, the vast majority of which came after Moscow started its special operation in the neighboring country in February. The list includes more than 1,400 Stinger anti-aircraft systems, over 8,500 Javelin anti-tank weapons, and 32,000 other anti-armor platforms, as well as some 988,000 howitzer rounds, 60 million rounds of small arms ammunition, and tens of thousands of mortars, rockets, and grenades. The Pentagon has also sent large quantities of heavy weaponry, among them over 150 artillery pieces, 20 Mi-17 helicopters, 200 M113 armored personnel carriers, hundreds of Humvees, and 16 high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, one of the longest-range platforms provided by Washington to date. In addition to non-lethal gear such as helmets, body armor, and mine-clearing equipment, the U.S. supplied Ukraine with at least 700 Switchblade suicide drones and an undisclosed number of Claymore anti-personnel mines. In its latest $1.1 billion aid package for Kiev, announced on Wednesday, 28th of September, the U.S. Defense Department vowed to more than double the number of HIMARS units operated by the Ukrainian military, seeking to send another 18 on top of the 16 already authorized. However, officials noted it could take a few years before the rocket systems are ready for the battlefield, as they will not be pulled from existing U.S. stocks, but rather contracted to American arms manufacturers. A senior Pentagon official told reporters the HIMARS are intended to serve as a core component of Ukraine's fighting force in the future, explaining that it is a sizable investment designed to prepare Kiev for the long haul. The apparent shift to a longer-term approach comes as some military experts warn that Washington will not be able to keep up the pace of security assistance set over the last 6 months, with CNBC noting mounting problems in the American weapons supply chain in a recent report. Russia's RIA Novosti news agency explains more about the same story. A new opinion poll conducted by the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft revealed nearly half of the American public are against sending military aid to Ukraine if the U.S. is not involved in diplomatic efforts to resolve the conflict. The opinion poll showed on Tuesday, 27th of September, almost half of the respondents, or 47%, said they only support the continuation of U.S. military aid to Ukraine if Washington is involved in ongoing diplomacy. About 40% of those who took part in the opinion poll expressed their support for providing weapons to Kiev, regardless of the negotiation process. Roughly 58% said they would oppose the U.S. providing military aid to Ukraine at current levels if their own country suffers higher gas prices and a higher cost of goods. The opinion poll also revealed that 57% of likely voters support the U.S. pursuing diplomatic negotiations as soon as possible to end the conflict, while only 32% oppose such efforts. Executive Vice President at the Quincy Institute, Trita Parsi, was quoted as saying in the release, "Americans recognize what many in Washington don't. Russia's special operation in Ukraine is more likely to end at the negotiating table than on the battlefield, and there is a brewing skepticism of Washington's approach to this war, which has been heavy on tough talk and military aid, but light on diplomatic strategy and on engagement." 6% of those surveyed further recognized that Russia's special military operation is among the top issues the U.S. is currently facing. Other concerns included inflation, gun violence in the United States, and the state of the U.S. economy. TASS news agency covers the same story but from a different angle. Head of the Russian delegation at the Vienna talks on military security and arms control, Konstantin Gavrilov, says the United States views the world as a range to test its weapons. Gavrilov made the statement in a speech at the plenary session of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Forum for Security Cooperation. He was quoted as saying in a speech published by the Russian Foreign Ministry, he said, "It has long been clear that Kiev's handlers in Washington view the whole world as a large testing ground and use any armed conflict, even if they are not directly involved in it, to test the effectiveness of their weapons." Konstantin Gavrilov said, according to a report by the Congressional Research Service on U.S. wars and military interventions around the world, since 1798, Washington has unleashed 469 wars and military interventions around the world. The Russian diplomat continued by saying, U.S. Professor J.S. Miller-Lucas concluded the U.S. wars since the Second World War have claimed an estimated 25 million lives with impunity. But Washington has no intention to stop. The diplomat noted U.S.-made weapons continue to be tested on civilians with the help of Ukrainian troops and radicals. He underlined, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry has openly invited companies of the United States military-industrial complex to test pilot projects before mass production, which will allegedly increase the competitiveness of these weapons if they are tested in a combat zone. Well, that's not new, of course. The international community remembers well how, in August of 1945, the United States tested nuclear weapons on civilians in the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Today, we are talking about the actual legalization at the government level of the use of Ukrainian troops and civilians, who will be the targets of these weapons as cannon fodder. Konstantin Gavrilov said Moscow is warning Washington and London against reckless moves that could push the situation around Ukraine to a dangerous point.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. O human, religion will never tell you not to rush. It will never tell you to stay at home and rest. It will never ever tell you not to use your energy. Anyone who tells you this in the name of religion is either ignorant or a liar. True religion never tells you to leave your energies idle. True religion tells you to do your utmost, to do your best, but to what end? True religion tells you to use your energy for something worthy of you, not for a bit of water and dirt, not for some paltry price, not for some worldly existence which, no matter how grand it is, will always be small for you. O human, strive for something that is worthy of your magnificence and equal to your stature. The human being is the greatest being in the cosmos, the most magnificent wonder of existence, second only to God, and yet it inhabits this tiny and limited form. O human, strive, make haste, but towards what? Towards your Lord's forgiveness in a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth. Strive for a paradise that is so great that it makes the heavens seem small and the earth seem insignificant. What does this mean? Pay close attention to the Quran's words so that you may understand. The Quran says, if you want to aim for something, the heavens and the earth are not worthy of you. They are small for you. So aim for something greater than these. O human, God's forgiveness is important for you. God's forgiveness is higher than everything else. And after forgiveness, there is something whose value and magnificence is greater than the heavens and the earth combined.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, what does forgiveness mean? We think it is when we say to someone, I apologize, I was rude to you, please forgive me. And that person, whether with kindness and magnanimity or in any other form, says, that's okay, don't worry about it. We think it means when we do something wrong by accident and we go to the person we wronged and ask for forgiveness, I'm sorry, please forgive me, and he says, that's okay, I forgive you. We think it means when we go to a government office because you've been overcharged on your taxes and you ask them kindly to help you solve your problem. Perhaps you take someone with you or a letter or ask someone to call on your behalf and they say, okay, we will refund you such and such an amount. This is how we imagine God's forgiveness. Someone does something wrong, they caused corruption in the earth and were worthy of God's punishment. Then on the day of judgment, because of a tear they shed or a plea they made, God will say, that's okay, I forgive you. Is that what we mean by God's forgiveness? Does this sound like something we're supposed to hasten towards? No, of course not.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.